One, two, three, four, five, yes?
Yes, Michael Nicholson, Reel 28. Yes, you were telling me about the...
The injurers, yes. We weren't even allowed to talk to... I mean, Sam Salt came aboard with his survivors. And again, it astonished me. They sat in... Well, the tank deck, I suppose it would be called, but the kind of hole they sat in. They were totally shocked, you'd imagine. And it was cold, very cold. And there they sat in the semi-darkness, of which I can only describe as a kind of cargo hold, for about half an hour before anyone came and helped them and took them away. And we tried to film them, and then we were stopped. We couldn't film them. Mustn't show tragedy. And then Salt was taken away and debriefed, and a few hours later, clean-shaven, with a clean shirt and everything else on, we were allowed to talk to him. Because by that time, he had recovered himself, he'd recovered his composure. But as we sat there before he was taken away, you know, the man was in tears. He sat there, surrounded by his survivors, having lost his ship, and he was, you know, there were tears in his eyes. And we weren't allowed to film Sheffield until 4 or 5 days later, and only because Sandy Woodward wanted to see the ship for himself and didn't have time to fly out there. What was it? You wanted me to remember? Was it that piece about Sam Salt? Did you want me to mention? It was, because I forgot. So that was our first casualty. The other absurd thing was that when these men were buried at sea, when the survivors were buried at sea, in the proper fashion, with a service and a blessing, and then the Union Jack draped over the canvas coffin, and it slid into the sea, you know, we've all seen it in the movies, we weren't allowed to film it. We were told it would not be decent. It would not be decent. Now, did they think that we were going to kind of satellite those pictures straight back home? Didn't they realize, as we told them time and time again, that it would be weeks before these pictures would ever be seen? By which time, you know, some of the scars would already be healing. But no, the pig-headedness of the military in its attitude to not just the press, but we're representatives of the people. You know, I'm not there simply for my own glory or ITN's glory. I'm there risking my neck in order that people back home can be told what's going on.
You're also recording history, aren't you?
Recording for posterity. And that's another thing, you know, just jumping ahead slightly. You know, we were having a hard time with the Navy, and one still does. That will never change. But when, you know, one hopes that the Army had a different attitude, and we thought it had when we first met Jeremy Moore, General Jeremy Moore. And we met him first time aboard Fearless, just prior to the invasion. And he said, "I'm glad you guys are around, because I want my son to see what his father did in the war." And we thought, oh, thank God, you know, at last we've got a bit of air, a bit of light, bit of common sense. But he was as bad as the rest. He was as bad as the rest. And I'll tell you why later. Anyway,
did you have any help at all, you know, still on this theme, from anyone on Hermes? You know, for instance, you've spoken about this lieutenant commander.
Rupert Nicol was our kind of deep throat, if you remember the Watergate and the film All the President's Men. There was a deep throat, a guy who was giving Woodward and Bernstein all the information anonymously. Well, Rupert Nicol was our kind of deep throat. He felt there was a gross injustice that we were not allowed to say more than we were allowed to say. I mean, he didn't give any secrets away, nor did we. I mean, whose side were we on? But he thought it was too restrictive. I mean, sometimes our copy would go through four censors. You know, first it would go to the captain, who was trying to fight a war. So his first instinct was to cross everything out. Then it would go to his second in command. Then it would go to Rupert. And then we were allowed to transmit. And, you know, transmitting was no easy job. We had to be... There was no telephone on board, no Marisat telephone on board Hermes that we were allowed to use. So we had to wait for a helicopter to become available, which wasn't always available, put on our survival suits, be airlifted, winched off Hermes, taken across maybe 3 or 4, 10 miles across the sea to the first Marisat ship, which was the Royal Fleet Auxiliary ships, and winched down in a very, very rough sea in our survival suits, often in blinding rain or fog. And then we would be allowed to stay on that ship and transmit our stories back home. And of course, Rupert was with us all the time, you know, to press the button if we said anything wrong. We could be there for days waiting for a helicopter to come and pick us up. Of course, there were deliberate delays, I'm certain of it, by the people aboard Hermes, because if we were out of the way, then we were out of the way and they didn't have to bother about us. So we were left on those Royal Fleet Auxiliaries for days and days, knowing that, you know, we could be back on Hermes. We should have been back on Hermes very quickly. But that was the kind of conspiracy. I remember the guy in charge of the helicopter operations telling me, I loathe you guys, you are at the bottom of the list. Yeah, exactly. Astonishing attitude. I remember describing one operation when we were aboard one of the small destroyers that went into one of the inlets and bombarded an Argentinian garrison. A very daring thing. It went in at night, opened up like mad, and then scarpered quickly. All great fun. And I reported this. I was allowed to report it. And I said at the end, this has been so successful, we'll do it again. You can bank on it. Now, that got back to Sir John Fieldhouse somehow as saying, we will go back tomorrow night, you see. And he lost his rag, complained to Woodward. Woodward called me into his office and said, I'm waiting for the transcript. If you have warned the enemy that we're going back, you're off the ship, you are sacked. That was his words, you are sacked. And I would have gone home, right? I said, but come on, I didn't say that. He said, I'm waiting for the transcript. And he actually broadcast the fact over the Tannoy system to the ship's company that I had actually given away at great risk to our intentions. And of course, the people were coming up, people who had been friendly before to me, an ordinary rating saying, best thing for you, mate, is a canvas bag over the side, you know, that kind of stuff. And I felt so inhibited that I didn't want to go into the wardroom that night to have dinner. I thought, you know, they'd boo me, throw things at me. I felt so bad. And it was only Bernard Heskey who said, you're going to come in, mate, if I have to carry you in. And I went in, and it wasn't so bad after all. But when the transcript came through from Northwood, from Fieldhouse, there was nothing in it about tomorrow night. It was, as I said, it was so successful, we're going to do it again, or they will do it again. But do you think Woodward apologized to me? Do you think he went out on the Tannoy and said, there's been a terrible mistake, Nicholson never said that, I do apologize? No. It only eventually filtered out. And I never forgave him for that. I thought it was a dastardly thing to do. But it was part and parcel of the attitude that they all had. They were quite happy to give you little interviews on deck, you know, because of their own ego. But when it came down to the real nitty-gritty of a man-to-man relationship, officer to journalist relationship, it wasn't there. And it was the same with Moore. Anyway, where were we? I was transferred 2 days before. We were called up by Woodward and told that the invasion was on. Obviously, we couldn't announce it. Of course not. I was then transferred to Canberra for an hour or so, then airlifted on to Fearless. And Phyllis was the ship that became the kind of command ship for the invasion into San Carlos water. It, as you know, happened, I think it began about 2 o'clock in the morning, pitch dark. The Paras were to go ahead first, then the Royal Marines, who I was with on Fearless, were going to follow. We were on the tank deck, which is the deck below deck, if you understand, and then the underground deck. It was almost pitch black except for small red lights, emergency lighting. I think there must have been 200 or 300 Marines there, all with blackened faces and bits of British hedgerows in their helmets and bandoliers of bullets, all ready to go. Now, you know, we didn't know what was ashore. We could hear this bombardment above us, but we didn't know it was going out or coming in. We assumed the Argentinians were on shore waiting to receive us. And if I tell you that the last movie that was shown aboard Hermes before we all left for our action stations, if I tell you that the last film that was shown to the ship's crew was Gallipoli, which shows endless invasion forces being machine gunned down by the Turks, that is what they showed. Isn't it astonishing? It just reminded me that during that film, it suddenly stopped, the lights came on, and guys came running down to the front to talk to the senior officers there, Woodward, and Lynn Middleton, the rest of them, and they all got up and left, and the film carried on. It turned out that a Sea King helicopter had gone down with 18 men aboard, and those 18 men were all SAS. On their way, we were told later, to Chile, where they were going to land with the permission of the Chilean military, of course, I assume, and then make their way into Argentina to report on the air traffic coming out of the military airfields. And they were being transferred from one ship to another to go on their way. And we were told that an albatross had flown into the air intake of the Sea King helicopter. That was the official explanation. Of course, it wasn't that at all. We later learned that, one, it was heavily overloaded, 18 men on board with all their kit. Only one pilot, and there's always two in a Sea King, because they were so stretched for pilots. I mean, they had helicopters, but they didn't have the pilots. These pilots are working their backsides off. So, you know, a tired pilot on his own, at night, in a rough sea, overloaded in the oldest helicopter in the fleet, because once they'd landed there, they were going to set fire to the helicopter. All these factors combined, to my mind, contributed to the fact that the pilot made a mistake and ditched. And they were all drowned, never got them back. That was another one of our unreported tragedies. I'll tell you one little anecdote. I was talking about censorship and the attitude of the military. Before I left Hermes, we had four Harriers on deck, three or four Harriers on deck, all wired up to battery, already, pilots sitting in the aircraft, cockpits back, sitting in the aircraft, ready to go at 30 seconds notice. It was foggy. You actually couldn't see the ski jump at the end of the ship, you know, the little jump that helps them take off. And so these guys were never flew. And that evening I said to David Morgan, one of the pilots, I said, well, a bit of luck today that you didn't go. You'd have problems getting back. He said, we wouldn't have got back. What do you mean wouldn't get back? He said, well, had we flown to furthest intercept point, and don't ask me how many hundreds of miles it is, it may be 200 or 300 miles, and had we been in combat, we would not have had enough fuel to get back and find our mothership. I said, well, come on, you've got radar. He said, but the radar would bring us back to a ship or simply to a group of ships. It would not identify the mothership, Hermes. Today, that's all different. They can do that, but 20 years ago, apparently, they couldn't. So David said he would have had to hover around looking for Hermes in the fog. And he had only had 2 minutes fuel to do that. He said almost certainly he would have had to ditch. I said, you've got a £10 million aircraft and you can't fly. He said, well, that's it. Because we weren't allowed to report this. It's a great story. But we weren't allowed to report it. I could understand why that was too embarrassing for the Navy. But we were still uptight about it. But then a Met officer, I won't mention his name, but a Met officer said, yeah, but there is another reason, gentlemen, come with me. And he took us to the Met office, and there was the map of the total exclusion zone with the Falklands in the middle. And he said, well, there we are. You see this patch of fog here? That's where we are. We're in this fog. Now, you go out on BBC World Service tonight and say we're in fog. All the Argentinian Met has to do is look at their maps and say, ah, there's the patch of fog. That's where they are. And send the exocets to greet us. So, you see, that was the kind of that was the kind of relationship that should have existed all along. Once it was explained why we couldn't report something, you know, there was no gripe. But simply say, you can't report it, it's top security, you know, treated us like kids. So that was, I always use that experience, that episode, to explain to people that, you know, treat us like adults, sensible people, people who are on your side, and we'll all get on much better. But that was an exception. So where were we? Oh yes, I'm talking about the 300 Marines on the tank deck. All kids, of course. I mean, all such young fellas. 18, 19-year-olds, you know, 20-year-olds. I always say, don't I, that wars are started by old men and fought by young men. And there they were, these kids. Of course, absolutely terrified. You could hear this bombardment. And they were all expecting, having seen Gallipoli only a few nights before, to be mowed down as they crossed the beach. And the tension was awful. Tension was dreadful. And suddenly, Sergeant Major, caricature of a Sergeant Major, stereotype Sergeant Major, you know, shaved head, lantern jawed, stiff upper lip and all that, shouted out, "No X!" And a little voice says, "Yes, sir." "Stand up, No X." So up stood No X, and he was about 5 foot tall. He looked it anyway, almost as wide. Lovely round face, a big smile, blackened face, camouflage, covered with bandoliers and carrying a bit of a heavy machine gun, and they are heavy. Sergeant Major says, "What's that you're wearing, No X?" And No X said, "It's a bra, sir." And of course he was. Everyone turned and peered through the dark. There was this little guy with a bra across his bandoliers. And the Sergeant Major said, "May I ask, No X, while you're wearing a bra?" He said, "It's my girlfriend's bra, sir. And I think it's every Marine's duty to wear his girlfriend's bra on invasion day," or worse to that effect. And Sergeant Major said, "Well, too bloody right, No X," he said. "And when this war's over, I'll pin the medal on that bra for you." And of course, you can imagine everyone started laughing, and he broke it like that. And within minutes, we were up and away. It was just like a movie, you know. If you saw it in the movie, it was too corny. You know, no script writer in Hollywood would put that into a film because nobody'd believe it. But it happened. It happened. And years, when the war was over, I got a lovely letter because, you know, I told that story again and again. That autumn, I got a letter from his mother saying, you know, "Thank you for it. You know, we didn't know it happened, but that was so like Michael that it meant so much to us."
Did he survive?
No, he died 3 days before the war ended, and his name is on the commemorative wall in Port Stanley. So that's how we went ashore. A lot of delays. The Paras cocked it up a bit. Well, you know, it wasn't their fault. They're not used to going ashore in landing craft. They're used to dropping out of aircraft. But we went ashore unopposed, of course. Unopposed. The SAS or the SBS had been into this place a few days earlier, and I think the term is taken out. a few Argentinians were there. Because, you see, the Argentinians could never believe that we were going to land there. They thought we would come in head on into Port Stanley, or at the Port Stanley end of the island. It took him completely by surprise. Otherwise, you know, it would have been a very bloody landing indeed.
Did you hear anything about the decision for the landing place while you were on Hermes? Would that have come into it?
No, we didn't know until we were just about to leave Hermes for Canberra and then Fearless. We were told that was St. Carlos Water. Behind that was a man called Major Ewan Soutphy-Tellier. It's an astonishing name. An astonishing man. Again, straight out of Hollywood. A lovely Soutphy-Tellier, a Royal Marine Major. And he had spent some time on the Falklands previous as part of the guard to the governors, the governor. And he's a very keen sailor, and he'd spent quite a lot of time sailing around the Falklands in his spare time. And he'd kept a book of the inlets and the tides and the depths and, you know, whether there's rocks here, rocks there. And the story is, well, whether it's true or not, I don't know. Certainly it's one he tells, that when they were about to leave Southampton, his name wasn't on the list. So he went up to his commanding officer and said, you know, I've got this exercise book full of information about the inlets and creeks and blah, blah, blah of the Falklands. It'd be quite invaluable when you decide where you're going to land. And so his commander says, well, give it to him. And he said, no, sir, you take it, you take me. And so they said, oh, we'll take you too. And that, apparently, anecdotally, apocryphally, I don't know, is how Ewan Taylor got to the Falklands. But they decided, apparently it was on his information and his recommendation that they landed in St. Carlos Water. And he tells me that the night before, you know, he was in a deep sweat about, you know, whether he'd got it right. You know, he was now responsible for the landing in a way. And if he hadn't mapped it properly or got the tides wrong or there were rocks there and where he hadn't noticed, you know, it would be his fault. But it was an easy landing and it went off. Textbook fashion. And then we all moved, you know, we all moved ashore. The Paras went off one way and the Marines went off the other for what was called the Yomp. I mean, I think, trying to think the distance, I think it was about 60 miles from, between 40 and 60 miles from San Carlos to Port Stanley, across the most rugged terrain you can possibly imagine. I mean, if you're not climbing over sharp rocks, cutting your boots to pieces, you know, you're soaking them in swamps and marshlands. It was, and you can imagine, it was bitterly cold, snowing. Not deep snow, but snowing.
How well protected were you all?
Not at all. I think if anyone was protected, I think the press were best protected of all, because, you know, we've taken our own stuff, but the British troops, you know, because it was such a rush, had not brought winter gear. And there were these poor young lads in just their ordinary tunics, these light tunics, cotton tunics, when they should have had, you know, really heavy. I mean, the Argentinians, of course, were prepared for it. They had these wonderful body warmers and proper boots and proper headgear, gloves. Our guys didn't. And believe me, there was many a British soldier who looked like an Argentinian towards the end of it, because, you know, when they came across a dead body, they would just take his body warmer off and put it on themselves. And some of them were using Argentinian boots, because our boots were leaking like mad. But, you know, this of course is due to the fact that the British Army is badly equipped. But also, to be fair, it was such a rush. And I gather that the Atlantic Conveyor, of course, who I forgot to mention, was hit by an excess set that was also meant for Hermes. It was on his way to Hermes, apparently, when it saw an even bigger target. And these exocets have a kind of photographic or a shadow on their computer, and it was aiming for Hermes, but suddenly on its computer it saw an even bigger target, so it switched target and hit Atlantic Conveyor. And on Atlantic Conveyor were not only the more helicopters for us, which would have ended the war much sooner, but spare parts and rations and winter clothing. But that all went down into the South Atlantic. So our poor guys are off. The next big episode, of course, was towards the end. There was lots of long-range artillery, and I think I made the right decision. I realised that this is not a television war. You know, our staff, even if everything went smoothly, and seldom did, was going to take 4 weeks to get back to London. You know, it was going to take time it was sorted out in the Falklands, time we found a ship that was sailing for the Ascension, the time it took to be processed in Ascension and satellited to, not processed, it was video, got to Ascension Island and then taken to London. You know, it was 2 to 3 weeks at the best. So I decided that, you know, this was a war that had to be reported daily, 3 times daily if possible. So I really stuck close to the radio sets, the radio ships, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary ships, which were anchored in San Carlos water. And I'd go out for part of the day, see what was going, come back, do a phono. So I was on air every night, every day. A lot of people made mistakes of going off for 2 or 3 days and coming back with a long feature piece, you know. That's not what London wanted. London wanted the news now. Even if it was just, you know, what Tommy Atkins was wearing today and what he said, you know, that's all they wanted. Another guy who made the very right decision was Max Hastings, Sir Max. He was a good buddy of mine. And he made the same decision. No heroics for him. He left that to the very last day. But just keep filing, you know, as often as you can. And he got a very bad reputation, Max, out there, partly because of what he is. You know, he's a tall, gangling toff with an infuriating posh accent. But, my God, what a grafter he was. And, you know, the telex was on and off, on and off. You could never rely upon it. And he would sit up all night waiting for it to come on in order to fire while a lot of other reporters were asleep under the tables. First-class guy, a journalist. I told you a funny story at the end about him. Now he almost lost his life on the last few days. So I reported every day. Others didn't, and were disappointed to find that London weren't interested when they came back because events had overtaken them.
How did you take to radio compared with television? It must be very different.
No, not really. I love writing, I love descriptive writing. And I found I took to it like a duck to water. You know, some of my phonos, you know, which is what we call them in television, a telephone piece, in which they put your face up on the screen and just hear your voice. You know, 5, 6, 7, 8 minutes long. The longest was 13 minutes, which was, of course, the one at the end. But the description of Sir Galahad, I think, was 11 minutes.